I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with British novelist Christy Watson. But first up, author Mary Norris. Mary joined the editorial staff of The New Yorker in 1978 and has been a copy editor and proofreader there for more than 30 years. She has written for The Talk of the Town and for NewYorker.com on topics ranging from her cousin, Dennis Kucinich, to mud wrestling in Rockaway. She is best known for her pieces on pencils and punctuation. Her first book is Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, published by Norton. I'm pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Mary.
Hi, Nicole. Pleasure to be with you.
Oh, and so I'm sure listeners want to know, are you wearing your crown for this interview, I hope?
No, the crown is standing on the table in the hallway.
Wow. Could you start by telling us about your book and how it came to be?
Yes. Well, the book is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. And it really started when I wrote something for the New Yorker's website in defense of the New Yorker's use of commas. A writer named Ben Yagoda had written in the New York Times on their website a piece about commas, and he made light fun of our overuse of commas. And two young women who were working on the website asked me to write a rebuttal. And at first I did not really want to. I didn't think commas seemed like the most interesting subject in the world. But I went ahead, I saw that I could do it, and I saw that I should do it, have some team spirit. And also I was the holder of the comma shaker, this little tin with perforations on the lid that a legendary proofreader had wrapped paper around and drawn commas on, and she called it the comma shaker. The joke was that we sprinkled in the commas. So that gave me an opening, and I was able to write the piece. And though I'd been writing for many, many years, decades, this piece about commas gave me the widest readership I had ever had.
That's interesting, because I did developed this strange habit of counting the number of commas in the first sentence in the short story in The New Yorker, because that seemed to be a good place to find a wealth of them. So you began your career or your working life as a milk delivery person?
Well, that was one of the jobs I had after I graduated from college, yes. It was one of the best jobs. It was the best job I ever had. I drove a milk truck. I had a route in Fairview Park, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland on the west side. And what was wonderful about it was independent. It was outdoors. I've always loved being outside on a nice day. And, no one was watching me. And it was a sales job, which I hadn't thought I'd be good at, but I liked milk, I liked cows, I liked all the products of cows, and I found I could be enthusiastic about selling it. So I only did that for about 6 months in the winter and spring. It must have been of 1976 or 1975, and then I returned to graduate school in Vermont.
Okay, and then can you continue? Because we all want to know how you made it from Ohio to The New Yorker.
Well, I had left Ohio to go to college in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I went to Rutgers, Douglas College of Rutgers University. And so I was a little bit familiar with New York because I'd gone east in order to be near New York City. Then I didn't have any plans on graduation, so that's when I went home and took these odd jobs like the milk route, and I also worked at a costume company and went back to graduate school in Vermont, spent 2 years up there. I learned to milk cows up there, and I worked in a cheese factory packaging mozzarella. That was my first job on obtaining my master's in English. And from there, I came to New York. I had a sibling who lived here in New York and who had a loft in the financial district, and Dee was going to Paris that winter and offered me the place. I would not have moved to New York without a job or a place to stay, but once I had a place to stay, I felt like I could find a job. Dee also introduced me to Peter and Jan Fleshman, who were friends. Dee had met Jan Fleshman at art school at the Art Students League. Peter, her husband, was the chairman of the board of the New Yorker. Because he was the head of the business department, and they were strictly separate, business and editorial, at the New Yorker, he couldn't actually give me a job, but what he did was give me an introduction to the executive editor at the time, whose name was Robert Bingham, and give me an opportunity to call him and talk to him. There were no openings on the day that I went in to talk to Mr. Bingham, but with Peter's encouragement, a few months later, I called back. I was just on the verge of trying to get a hack license to drive a taxi in New York, and Peter must have sensed an ambulance in my future and tried to get me to get a safer job, and there were openings. So I took two typing tests, one for the typing pool, which I failed, and one for the editorial library, which is the archive of the magazine, and that one I passed. So that was my entry-level position at the New Yorker. I worked in the editorial library, taking apart the magazine literally with a razor blade, pasting columns into individual writers' scrapbooks, summarizing and indexing articles and short stories and even poems we summarized and had them on file in case people wanted to track down a certain issue. We could usually find it for them if we had enough information.
I'm talking to Mary Norris. Her book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen, was just published by Norton. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Mary, those steps you were talking about that your first job entailed with the razor blades and everything, that was the kind of stuff behind the scenes that was particularly fascinating. And so we have this beloved cultural institution, and I like the way that you humanize it by sharing these stories of good saves and maybe some blunders. And can you take us through the steps that now your job entails, so that go into editing or improving a piece that comes into the New Yorker? So an author turns one in, and then what happens?
Well, the editor works with the author, and they work out together any changes that the editor might want, and they bring the piece to a certain point when they know it's going to be publishable, and then they send it to the copy desk at the New Yorker. That's the first going over that the piece gets by one of the copy editors, and it's very minimalist, just spelling and New Yorker style, you know, putting the two dots, the diaresis, over the second O and coordinate, things like that. And then it gets read in galley. It's entered into the system. It gets read in galley by an okayer or a query proofreader. That's the position I hold. There are about six of us who do this job and five of us, who read things in galley. That used to be the job of one of the legendary New Yorker proofreaders named Eleanor Gould, and it is still called Goulding. Her name became a verb because it was done so much and she was so famous. Then the piece, once it's scheduled for publication, the week that it's scheduled for publication, we read it again. That is the fact checker, the proofreader, the okayer, the editor, and the author. And everyone gives their suggestions to the editor. Those are all entered into the system on an electronic file, and it goes to what we call the makeup department, which other places might call production or layout. And then that new page proof is distributed again to the same group of people, the okayer, the fact checker, the author, and the editor. And we sit down, we all read it and sit down together and go through it a page at a time. And anyone who has further refinements suggests them. The okayer, that would be me, keeps a paper trail. We make a new proof with all the changes on it, and then the okayer enters those into the electronic file, and a new version is produced by the makeup department, and then there's a safety net of proofreaders called the foundry proofreaders, and they read the old version that the okayer has made, that's called the reader's proof, comparing it with the new version, and catching any errors or any word breaks or anything odd in the typography. And by then, we hope it's perfect.
Wow. And you mentioned the six people who hold your position and Goulding. And you tell a story in the book about Hobie Weeks, who's a now deceased, I understand, former style editor, who was said to almost change the magazine's policy on diuresis. But what actually struck me about, I mean, that's a great story, but what jumped out at me was that he had begun working there in 1928 and was a co-worker of your predecessor. So what's the average tenure of somebody working in the department there?
I was surprised, actually, to learn that Hobie Weeks died approximately when I came to the New Yorker. It must have been about 1978. I think the average length of service for some people is really long. I've been there about 35 years now, and my boss, Ann Goldstein, the head of the copy department, has been there about 40 years. People tend to stay. Not everybody, but a career at the New Yorker can cover decades. One thing that is true, certainly, of a certain vintage of New Yorker employee is that we feel that there's no better place to work. Once you've worked at the New Yorker, it's hard to go and work at another magazine. I think there are some people who have left and have gone on to wonderful careers, say, with the New York Times Magazine. People have become reporters elsewhere, and there is life after the New Yorker. I don't mean to imply that there's not, but there are people who come and stay. And I would say that 25, 30 years is not that unusual.
Mary, would you read to us from your book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen?
I'd be happy to. I'm going to read the beginning of Chapter 2, which is called That Witch. I always forget that in the popular imagination, the copy editor is a bit of a witch, and it surprises me when someone is afraid of me. Not long ago, a young editorial assistant getting her first tour of the New Yorker offices paused at my door to be introduced, and when she heard I was a copy editor, she jumped back as if I might poke her with a red-hot hyphen or force feed her a pound of commas. Relax, I wanted to say. I don't make a habit of correcting people in conversation or in print, unless it's for publication and they ask for it or I'm getting paid. We copy editors sometimes get a reputation for wanting to redirect the flow, change the course of the missile, have our way with a piece of prose. The image of the copy editor is of someone who favors a rigid consistency. A mean person who enjoys pointing out other people's errors. A lowly person who is just starting out in her career in publishing and is eager to make an impression. Or, at worst, a bitter, thwarted person who wanted to be a writer and instead got stuck dotting the I's and crossing the T's and otherwise advancing the careers of other writers. I suppose I have been all of these.
Thank you. That was Mary Norris, reading from her new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, Mary, could you talk about the structure of this book? So there are 10 chapters plus an epilogue. How did the structure come out and the chapter topics and...
Well, I knew that there were certain topics that I would have to address. One of them is the difference between that and witch. One of them was spelling. One of them was gender. That is what, you know, the English language does not have what we call an epicene pronoun, something that means both he and she. There is also the title of the book, Between You and Me, which is meant to point out that should not be between you and I, and I try to define, without resorting to Latin, the grammatical reason for using me, which is in the objective case, and not I, which is the nominative, all those words that make people's eyes glaze over. Then there's a chapter on commas, which is central to the book. That's called comma, 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 chameleon. And a chapter on hyphens. That my title for that was Who Put the Hyphen in Moby Dick? And there are chapters on other marks of punctuation. There's kind of a grab bag of the dash, the semicolon, and the colon. There's a chapter on the apostrophe, which is kind of threatened right now. I think the most popular chapter, the one that people turn to first, is chapter 9, which is on profanity, the dirty parts. And it ends with an ode to the pencil, because I still work in pencil on paper. I'm a bit of a pencil junkie. So what I did was I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I have a wonderful editor at Norton. His name is Matt Weiland. And it was Matt's job to shape the book. That is, I'm one of those people who can't see the forest for the trees. It's an occupational hazard. I'm very detail-oriented. So when I was asked to do something, I just add more detail. And what I was not so good at was shaping a chapter. And so it was Matt who determined the order things would go in and who encouraged me to write beginnings and be a little broader, to go for a broader audience. I had a tendency to go into great detail about New Yorker style, which some people find interesting, but I don't think it's the subject of huge interest in a broad segment of the population, which is what we were hoping to please with this book. So I owe a great debt to the editor who shaped each chapter, and it took a long time to take shape. It was not clear what order the chapters would go in at first, but I think one of the first chapters to come together that I saw Matt's work on was the one about gender, which is called The Problem of Heesh, Chapter 3. And what Matt was after there was a blend of instruction, grammatical information, and New Yorker anecdotes, always anecdotes that would teach something somehow, and some of my own personal life, which is also there to illustrate points of grammar and usage.
Mm-hmm. Now, who gets credit for the structuring of the hyphen chapter, the Moby Dick mystery?
Well, I'm going to take credit for that one. What Matt told me about the hyphen was, write the best thing on hyphens that's ever been written. And it was an interesting challenge because the hyphen is a real nuts and bolts bit of the publishing process. You know, it ties words together. It's used to justify the end of a line by breaking word into syllables. And it's also very subtle, the use of the hyphen in compounding, that is, in making two words into one. And for that, I was very lucky when I visited Merriam-Webster and Company in Springfield, Massachusetts. I met the president of Merriam-Webster, who put me onto a book called Meet Mr. Hyphen and put him in his place. The author of that was Edward N. Teal, who had worked at Webster's, and he had grown up. His father before him was an expert in compound words and the use of the hyphen. So this book was a godsend. It explained things to me in a way that made me able to help explain them to other people. And at the same time, I was able to chase down this mysterious hyphen in the title of Moby Dick. Although the whale does not use the hyphen in his name, the title had a hyphen in it traditionally, and that's always been a mystery to me. So I use that as an excuse to do a little research into Herman Melville, whose work I've always liked, especially Moby Dick. So I visited his home, and I didn't have to visit his home in order to find the reason for that hyphen, but it helped. It helped to kind of stand behind the chair that Melville sat in while he was writing Moby Dick and see his view. And I think I developed a lot of empathy for poor old Melville.
I loved that chapter, and I had a realization reading your book about the word proofread and proofreader, because you use the phrase read proof, and then this light bulb went off for me that I realized where the term actually came from. It never occurred to me that it was literal. And yet, copy edit is two words.
That is, copy edit is, it's a funny word to be all over the place, but it's true. At The New Yorker, a copy editor is two words. The copy desk is one word. To copy edit has a hyphen, to copy edit. And I think it does. I might be wrong. I'm getting mixed up now, but copy editing as a gerund, I think, is two words, too. So other publications, certainly the Chicago Manual of Style, always makes copy editing one word and copy editor one word. So you see it all different ways, and it's a funny word for us all to be disagreeing on.
I agree. And it just struck me that it's so analogous to proofread, and yet, anyway, it's all clearly in flux as a phrase.
Yes, you're probably right. It probably the way of it will be to close it up. My first impulse, this was a word that I had to deal with when I was in the collating department. I had to decide one night whether copy editing should be one word or have a hyphen or two. And I made it one word. And the next day, a style notice went out making it two words so that everybody would know and nobody would make the mistake I had made the day before. So somebody had strong feelings about it. And that's who tends to win those battles. Whoever feels the most strongly gets to have her way.
Well, Mary, I'm afraid we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, did we leave out anything? Is there any favorite writing advice or style tips that we haven't covered that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I guess just the title, that if people automatically say, you know, if they want to say between Jane and I, that's not quite right. You would never say between I and Jane. So people, I wish they would feel more comfortable saying me when it's the right word instead of I. It's almost as if people think I is a formal version of me, and that's not so. Me is a perfectly good word when it's in the spot in the sentence that takes the objective case. And all you have to do is turn it around and put yourself first, and you see what feels natural. You don't have to know the grammar behind it, but it doesn't hurt, and that's why I've gone to some trouble to explain it in ways that I hope people will understand.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
That was Mary Norris, author of the new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, published by Norton. During the second half of the show, author Christy Watson will be here. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with Mary Norris. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Christy Watson. Christy is a British novelist and pediatric nurse. She holds an MA in creative writing from the University of East Anglia, where she won the Malcolm Bradbury Memorial Bursay, and has since published short fiction and other writings in numerous publications, including Wasafiri, Mislexia, Index on Censorship, The Guardian, and The Telegraph. She teaches creative writing at various institutions, including Birkbeck University, the Groucho Club, and Cambridge University. She has won the Costa First Novel Award and Waverton Good Read Award for her first novel, Tiny Sunbirds, Far Away, and was named one of Red's Hot Women of the Year in 2012. She lives in London. Her new book is Where Women Are Kings, just released in the U.S. by Other Press as a trade paperback. And I'm so pleased to have her on the show. Hi there, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, doing well. So I appreciate it, especially since it's nearing evening there in London, yes?
It's about 5:30, so we're still in day. We're okay.
Okay, good. Well, we find here on the show that no one introduces a book better than the author. So would you introduce your new novel to us?
I will certainly try. I would argue that nobody introduces a book as badly as the author, but oh. I'll give it a go, certainly. Where Women Are Kings is essentially the story of Elijah, who's a young boy, who's 7 years old when we first meet him in the story, and he's been passed from pillar to post in foster care in the UK. And he believes two things. He believes that wizards are real, and he has one inside him, and he believes his mama, his birth mother, loves him like the world has never seen love. And he struggles with this, but he finally gets adopted into a mixed-race family in the UK, and he begins to settle down. But then events take place that lead him to be very uncertain, and disastrous things happen. And, yeah, it's all about, I suppose, the power of love between him and his birth mother and his adoptive mother, Nikki, and the balance between the three of them.
Hmm. And a good portion of the book is told, well, from a tight third, basically from Elijah's point of view. And so I was wondering if you could talk about developing the character of Elijah and also tell us how you got into his head.
Yeah, I think I started dreaming about him, actually. And in my dreams, I imagined this young boy who had very sort of bizarre and quite damaging behaviours, but had a heart full of love. And I pictured him as this small child with these big eyes that were quite frightened. And so he kind of just came alive organically in my head. And I really wanted to explore, I think partly for two reasons. I'd spent a long time as a pediatric nurse working in intensive care, and I'd seen lots of children who'd suffered horrific abuse and the kind of things that had happened to them. But also I've been through the process myself as a mother of a child who I adopted. And so I really wanted to explore questions that I had about the system through this child. And I wanted to make his heart good and all the people around him good people trying to do their very best. Despite extremely difficult circumstances. But I think I'd like to take credit for Elijah because he's a wonderful character, but I think he chose me and he came to me, and it was something quite outside me. So, he's a great, great person and a heart full of love despite horrific difficulties that he struggled with in his early life.
Mm. And another point of view we have from Elijah's adoptive mother, Nikki, and then the third are in these letters from his mama. And so in terms of writing the book and in structuring it, did you always know that you would have these points of view, or how much work did you have to do to figure out that part of the book, the voices that would tell the story?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really challenging process writing anything. And I think for me, I've tried shortcuts, and the shortcuts end up making things longer. And so I always write about 10 drafts before I get to what the point of the story is. And no matter how I try and get around that, that seems to be the case in my working process. So it's quite painful. But I think initially I wrote from the point of view of Elijah only, but I realized that his story was bigger than he could tell it. And so I wanted another narrative, and I felt like to give it balance, because actually in his life, it was split, and it was split between his adoptive mother and his birth mother, and I wanted to give them both a voice and see that there are always differences and different sides of every single story. And it was a process. I think probably by about draft 10 of the novel, which sounds incredibly painful, I realized that it had to be told from three different points of view, and then it was a case of trying to find out how to do that. And I think that's when the letters from Deborah, from his birth mother, came to me, because I really wanted to write her in first person, but I felt like the letters would be a good chance to do that.
Wow. Could you read to us now to give listeners a flavor for the writing in your book?
Yes, absolutely. So I will go ahead and read from chapter 1. And this is the very start of the story after the prologue. Elijah, my lovely son, my beloved, I want to tell you your life. Everyone has a story inside them which begins before they are born, and yours is a bigger story than most of us will ever know. They say I shouldn't tell you some things, and that words can hurt little ears. But son of mine, there are no secrets between a mother and son. A child has seen the insides of its mother's body, and who can know a secret bigger than that? And they say a lot of things, those English. What they call child abuse, we Nigerians call training, so don't mind them. Your story begins in Nigeria, which is a place like heaven. There is continuous sunshine, and everyone smiles and takes care of each other. Nigerian children work hard at school, have perfect manners, and look after their parents, and respect the elderly. Nigeria is brightness and stars and earth like the skin on your cheeks, brown, red, soft, and warm. I am full up with proud memories from Nigeria. Most of all, I remember my family. Mummy, your grandmother, was famous for shining cooking pots and shining stories. Long ago, she would tell me and my sisters, a woman so full of empty sold her body as if it was nothing but meat for sale at the market. She traveled all over Nigeria, that woman, looking for something to fill up her insides, and learned many languages, something for words to explain the emptiness. And people liked this empty, clever woman. She was made of starlight, and her heart glowed silver. They listened when she spoke her many language words, telling the places she'd seen, of Jos, where the sky rained diamonds, and the north, where the men disappeared inside walls of sand, and the delta creeks dancing with river spirits. And so the people made her king, and the land filled her up, and the emptiness was sky. Nigeria is a place where women are kings, where anything is possible.
Thank you. That was novelist Christy Watson reading from her new novel, Where Women Are Kings. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And as a mom, this story was difficult to read. You go to some very dark parent-child love places. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about any challenges you had with the material or whether you ever wanted to turn back?
Yeah, I was going through a very, very difficult year in my personal life, and so it was a challenging book to write anyway, but it was particularly challenging during that time, and I had to dig very, very deep. And I think had it not been for the support of my friends and family and the fact that I could hug my own kids regularly and separate myself from my work and just remind myself that these were imagined lives, horrific imagined lives, some of the circumstances, but I think the support I had from everybody really, really helped me get through it, because it was very, very tough to write. And there are parts of it now that I struggle to read, I'll be honest, and I wrote it. So, you know, it is a very, very, very emotional book, and I felt like it had to be how it was. And the characters, for me, they came alive, and they told me what they needed to say, and so I just sort of followed what they needed to do. And I really wanted to be true to that.
Christy, regarding the ending with 10 drafts and this difficult material, and you were talking about how the characters have their own paths that they were leading you down. At what point, I mean, without any spoilers, obviously, at what point did you know how it would end?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because most of the things I write, whether short fiction or novels, I don't really have an idea of how it's going to end. I just follow where things take me, and quite often the ending's quite different from how I imagined. But with Where Women Are Kings and Elijah, I knew it had to end as it ended, and I knew the whole way through. And so the ending never changed very much in all the drafts. And one of the things that's happened actually in the UK, because it's been out in the UK for a little while, is that people quite often come to me at book events and say, it was a difficult ending, but it had to end that way. And I felt very strongly about that.
Well, that's interesting. I was surprised by the ending. I mean, at one point, well, anyway, I won't go there because it's hard to do without a spoiler. But can we talk some more about revisions? Because our listeners like to hear this and compare processes. And it sounds like they're very intensive to you. So do you go from beginning to end and then redo the entire draft with something specific to focus on? Or how does your revision process work?
Yeah, I think, for the first book, which was Tiny Sunbirds Far Away, I wrote the entire novel in third person and then went back and wrote it in first person. So it was quite a change. I think it sometimes takes me to get to the end of the novel to understand what the truth about the novel is, or what the questions I'm trying to ask are, and sometimes I don't have any answers, but I think the process of writing a novel for me is about finding meaning to the questions that I have, and so it's not an unpleasant journey, it's a very difficult journey, but in terms of editing for your listeners who are maybe going through the whole process themselves, I think it's very important to keep in mind that it's a long journey, and you have to enjoy not just the destination, but how you're going to get there. And so each time that you edit and you look at a piece again and again and again, something new will happen to it.
We're talking to novelist Christy Watson. Her novel is Where Women Are Kings. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Christy, you were talking about revisions and also the long project of writing a novel, but you've published a good amount of short fiction as well. Could you talk about the difference between creating short fiction and writing a novel?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think short fiction was my first love. Tiny Sunbird, my first novel, grew out of a short story. And I love reading short fiction as well, but they're quite different in terms of art forms. And I think now the way I look at short fiction is you're dropping in on an incident about someone's life, and it needs to give you the whole life, whereas obviously you've got a lot more room in a novel to develop characters and develop that whole story. I think, in a way, short fiction is more challenging to write sometimes because you don't have room for any expansion of feeling or emotion. So it needs to be very succinct. And I think that's why I really like it. I find short fiction a challenge, and I really like that art form. I think it's more popular in America than maybe it is in the UK at the moment. But yeah, hopefully we'll follow suit.
So it's not the case that you used it as a learning ground for becoming a novelist, but you still write short stories.
I think most novelists do write short stories, and the problem with short fiction, particularly in the UK, is that you can't make a living from writing short fiction. So unless you are absolutely at the top of your game, I think it's very, very difficult to sell collections, particularly now with publishing as it is. So most novelists, you'll find they write really good short stories as well, and it's always a good idea to go and look at, if you've got a favourite novelist, to go and find out what they've written in terms of short fiction and also memoir or journalism pieces as well, because they can come out quite different in tone, and it's quite a good thing to do.
That is good advice, because they're gems when you find them unexpectedly.
Yeah, and they do pop up in unusual places. But some of my favourite novelists, well, my favourite novelist is Chimamanda Adichie, and she writes brilliant short fiction and brilliant essays as well. So I think it just gives you a different perspective of that writer.
Yeah, and I found with your book, in terms of the marketing slant maybe, there was a refreshing lack of categorization. So it's not, you know, it doesn't have one of these canonical women's fiction covers or anything like that. With your editors, did the discussion of category come up at any time in the pre-publication or process, or did they just let you write your novel and call it a novel and that was that?
Yeah, I think that's kudos to other press, my publishing company in the US. I mean, they are absolutely amazing, and they've done such a good job with the cover, which I absolutely adore. It's very hard to put me in a box. I'm a white British UK writer writing about culture and race and international issues, and so it's quite hard to put me in any category. And I've been on panels before where it's been a Black African writers panel, for example, thinking, why am I on this panel? So I think people, when they're trying to organize events or when they're trying to sell books, they like to put people in boxes because it makes it an easier sell. But none of us can really be put into a box. And I think most writers would be very anti being put into a box, particularly the women's writer box. I mean, that's... What does that mean? I'm not sure.
Well, there's this box that's, at least in the U.S., it's called women's fiction, and it's not romance, but it has to do with an emotional journey, or I'm just learning this stuff, but I don't like it, and I was glad that your book wasn't called that.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote Tiny... Again, I'm sort of referring back to my first book, but again, with Where Women Are Kings, I think it's... Somebody referred to it, who hadn't read it actually, as a domestic drama, and I thought it's really not a domestic drama. So I think there is a perception that women are going to write sort of kitchen sink domestic dramas that are emotionally charged, but actually most of the fan mail I've ever received and most of the positive reviews and everything have come from men. And so I think it's a nonsense, isn't it? And it's a marketing tool, and it's something that we have to use in order to get people to buy books sometimes. No doubt publishers have to use that sometimes. But I think from a writer's perspective, I'm never thinking about which box I'm going to put the book in when I'm writing it, that's for sure. And I would recommend to your listeners not to do that at all. I think you should just write for maybe one reader in mind, or write the kind of book that you want to read, but certainly don't think about the box you'll be put in, because no doubt it will be a different box than what you'd imagined anyway.
Mm. We're talking to novelist Christy Watson. Her novel is Where Women Are Kings. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Christy, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, I would like to ask you, do you have any more writing advice for listeners?
I've got lots and lots of advice, most of the time which I don't take myself, but I think my biggest piece of advice for anyone who wants to write is to turn off that voice in your head that says you can't do it, that it's no good, that you're no good, that no one will ever read it, because that voice never goes, and you can have the most success as a novelist and you will still hear that voice. And I think a lot of writing is overcoming that voice in your head that tells you you can't do it. So find a way to silence the voice, sit down and write and read and read and read as much as possible. And that would be my biggest advice.
Well, Christy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Christy Watson. Her new book is Where Women Are Kings, just released as a trade paperback with Other Press. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.